Hello, welcome back to Starting to Scale. I hope you have had a great 2 weeks. Sorry, a little apology from me. I like to publish a podcast episode every week, but with lockdown and 4 children, I have been really kind of stretched and I haven't managed to get round to doing it. But I'm going to make up for that because I've got some amazing podcast interviews that I've been doing over the last few weeks, which are going to be coming up over the coming months. And today I've got Zafran O'Sullivan. She's the founder of 5 Dot Botanics, and it's a minimal ingredient skincare brand. So they only use 5 ingredients. She is doing so well. She's already secured investment while she was heavily pregnant with her 3rd child. And with her background in law, we have some really interesting discussions around the importance of putting IP protection in place, and also just talking to her about the business and her mission and her vision and where she sees it going. And this is an industry that is ripe for disruption, and I think she has created an amazing brand. So I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, Emmy. Thank you so much for having me. So I'm Zafran. I'm one of the co-founders of 5 Dot Botanics. It's a minimal ingredient skincare brand based in London. We launched in July of 2019, and it was really set up as a challenger to the beauty industry's long ingredients lists that we were seeing on a lot of skincare products.
Yes, I remember reading that. You've got 5 ingredients, haven't you? And I was reading somewhere in one of the press articles, I think, about your business that a lot of beauty brands are using 20 or maybe even more products in their ingredients list. And I was thinking that's amazing that you're only using 5 products and it works.
Yeah, I know. And it was a really funny one because we were looking at where people's lifestyles were going. So, you know, in food, you have, you know, radical transparency, even in your cleaning products, down to, you know, people questioning who made my clothes. But in the beauty space, you never really challenged why there was 30 ingredients on the back of your list. You just assumed, well, I have to accept it. But actually, we've seen a big movement of people suddenly wondering, you know, what are the products? What are the ingredients? Are they synthetic chemicals? What's the impact of using those ingredients over 10, 20, 30, 40 years? And actually, you know, is there really a choice for me to have greater transparency and greater control? So we just thought the best way to give people that kind of absolute control and clarity was 5 ingredients. And people often ask, you know, why 5? But when we spoke to our cosmetic scientists at the start, when we were setting it all up, we were like, you know, what's enough to be able to create innovative products, but not so much that it creates confusion? And we settled on 5 as being enough to be able to give large proportions of great ingredients, but also enough to be able to innovate a nice product range.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, with just 5 products, are you going to be able to launch lots of different products? But obviously, you've done all that research and you know that you can.
Yeah, and actually, it's a real change of mindset. So we're used to kind of, beauty's become a little bit like fashion. We've got fast beauty launches happening all the time. And actually, we're the counterbalance to it. We're slow beauty. You're not going to get 10 product launches from us a year. You're never going to have a catalogue of 50 products on our website. I think we will be adding new products. So we're looking at a 5-ingredient sunblock. We're looking at a lot of different products. So our product range will increase. But I think we may take products off the range. So we're never going to be a range that has tons and tons of products. We don't believe you need 10 care step program to have great skin. So we're kind of slowing the beauty industry down. We're against fast beauty launches. We believe you can have a really nice kit of products, but we don't need to be greedy.
No, I love that. I love that. And I think so many people resonate with that. So just very quickly, I was reading that Brian was a scientist before. So has that got anything to do with why this launch? Or is that just kind of a total coincidence? And
We never really set up to have a business together, but I think it's really important when you do with anybody, he's obviously my husband, but is that you have complementary skill sets. So we're very, very different. Our values are aligned to what the brand is, but we do have a different approach. I think his science background helps, but we outsource all of the scientific thinking and formulation to a scientist, a cosmetic formulator. But I think it did probably help in terms of creating an interest for him in terms of that product and, you know, it being a challenge to create something that was innovative with just fewer ingredients.
So where did this idea come from? You told me that you launched it when you were pregnant with your third. Is that right? But you've been thinking about it ever since the birth of your second. Did you just think, I want to launch a brand and a business and then do the research and think about what is up, you know, right for disruption? Or did you always have this idea about creating a minimalist skincare range specifically?
It's a bit of two, really. I had always knew I wanted to create a business, but actually the transition from owning a business to creating a brand is different. It's very subtle, but it's quite a significant difference, because you can sell stuff in exchange for cash. But actually I realized deep in me was a desire to create a meaningful brand with purpose, or a mission that was beyond the products, and that could speak to people. So I already had a sense of whatever it needed to be was going to be something touching consumers. If I had known more about the beauty industry, I don't think I would have ever had the courage to go into the beauty industry. It's noisy, there's massive players, everyone, you know, it's almost like the worst possible industry to sort of go into. But actually, in a weird way, it was also one of the ones that was ripe for disruption and to be challenged about its old ways of being. The idea, I'm not a beauty geek. I hadn't been in beauty. It's a little bit like fashion. I felt like I was on the outside. But what I did have very, very clearly in my mind was the idea of transparency across things. Whether that was, you know, I was already thinking about food. I was already thinking about my hair care and skincare. But had beauty not be evolving, so had indie beauty brands not started to thrive in this space because consumers were now moving away from buying products from multinationals, if that trend hadn't started, I don't think we would have gone into beauty because it would have been too difficult. But two things had allowed us to try to do it. One was social media allowed us to have this conversation with our audience and test out the idea way before we put any money in. And two, indie beauty was becoming a thing. You know, people were looking for clean beauty. People were looking to support smaller brands. And that shift in consumer buying gave us enough confidence to say, okay, it's not going to be an uphill battle. Weirdly enough, 2 years ago, I was feeling impatient. I thought the moment is going for minimalist beauty and clean beauty. But the strange thing is, had I launched 2 years ago, we probably wouldn't have been as successful as we've been, because I would have had to spend so much time educating consumers about this concept of it. Whereas what's happened in the intervening 2 years is that consumers have caught up and they're ready for it now. So
that's brilliant. And also, it's good not to rush things, because I know we're all impatient as entrepreneurs. We're always impatient to do more and get on with things. But actually, often the magic happens when you actually have a bit of time to take things slowly. And I love the way that you're talking about, you know, that you had the time to do the research, to research what your customers wanted, and using social media and things like that, which I think is really, really important to, before you even spend any money, before you put, you know, significant amounts of money in it, to test the audience and to find out that there is a need. And so why do you think the industry is ripe for disruption? We've talked about it a bit. Is it just that people are desperately wanting something that, I don't know, they can sort of trust more, that they feel is more sustainable, or is it lots of things?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. One, I think people have become really story-led. It's not just the beauty industry, it's every industry. People are suddenly thinking, oh, the biggest power I have, even more powerful than the vote, is how I spend my money. And actually, people have also seen huge things happen, whether it's Brexit, whether it's the election of Trump. And they're saying, you know, where do I actually have power? And actually, who they choose to buy from is their greatest power. And so what you've had is this slow shift in consumer perception. And also people suddenly going, I love brands with people behind them. Beauty, when you're, there's some amazing brands within some of those multinational groups, whether it's Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Estee Lauder, L'Oreal, but they find it very hard to talk passionately about why they chose something, the adversity or the struggle they faced with something else. And actually consumers are interested in that.
Definitely. I can see that. We both love LinkedIn, don't we? And when I tell my story on LinkedIn, everyone's so much more interested. And I think it's the same with you. You know, people want to know the story. They want to know about you. And I know it's that word authentic, which can be overused, but it is about being authentic, isn't it? And it's about people resonating with you, because you set up the brand and what you stand for and all of those things. So that's really exciting. So what stage is the business at currently?
So we started, we're going to be 1 year old in a couple of months. We launched primarily direct to consumer, and the ambition was always to really be online, because I kind of didn't really see myself as a wholesaler. It was just too removed from the people. And because we have this mission, which is about kind of doing good, better beauty, slower living, actually having that connection with the customer was super important. But when we launched our mailing list had like 650 people on just from social media that had signed up. They were our first customers. So we didn't really mind. And we have full-time day jobs. We have kids. I was pregnant and sick throughout all of it. I didn't necessarily pursue retail deals. Because I was just like, this is great, I can manage this. But we got a couple of retailers interested. So Farm Drop in London, who do a lot of the grocery deliveries, were looking at sort of founder-led beauty brands. They were interested in the clean space. And we were interested in them because of their interest in the provenance of food. And they already had cars on the street delivering, you know, vans delivering things. So it was a really efficient way to do it. And they resonated with us. And then Holland & Barrett, which is an unusual one because we didn't go into all of their stores, but they were suddenly seeing the impact of clean beauty and their consumers really wanting it. And they didn't want clean beauty from big companies. They wanted clean beauty from independent brands. And that's really hard to find because you can get your kitchen sink formulators, but actually getting an independent brand that's ready to market, everything's legally compliant and shelf ready for a big retailer is, there's a bit of a disconnect finding them. And so we were ready. We were like, we've got all the paperwork. It's all fine. You can't order too much. And we only wanted to go in there one store. So that was a really great test for us to have a retailer like Holland & Barrett. The work to get listed with someone like that is huge. So it was a big learning curve, but without any of the hassle of having to go into, say, 100 stores. There were some smaller retailers, but D2C is our primary platform.
Yeah, and that's great, isn't it? I mean, I think selling direct to consumer is fantastic, and I think that's totally possible. What I was going to ask, something that I just thought then is you're a lawyer, aren't you? So presumably when you said you had everything ready to go and all the legal stuff, you know, that must be a massive benefit for you that you've got that sort of in your background in launching this business. And, you know, is there a lot of compliance that you need to go through when you're launching a beauty brand? And did it help the fact that you're a lawyer? Did you manage to take a lot of your learnings from that, or was it not actually that relevant?
Oh, 100%. And actually, because if you think launching a product, it's about your legal compliance and not feeling frightened by directives that govern how your product should be launched to market. It's everything from, you know, how you set your business up, who owns the IP, when does it transfer. We always built the business knowing that we would need a massive cash injections over time to scale, because it's not something you can scale without money. And so from day one, I was always thinking, like, if we were in due diligence with a investor, I don't want to be scrabbling around to fix paperwork. So people, I mean, at the start we were working, people was like, here's my letter, this is how IP will be assigned. And they were like, whoa, you know, you this is the back of an envelope. And why are you so intense about it? I said, because, you know, this will one day grow, and my power to negotiate what I need will be diminished, because we'll just, you know, we'll need it more than they'll need to give it to us. So everything was sort of being built as though we were going to get investment, even though I had no idea how we would get it. I guess it makes you unafraid of the paperwork that comes from retailers or things that look scary or where liability should sit. You're able to just take a measured judgment about how risk will unfold based on the wisdom of just how deals, you know, work out. And also that things might go wrong. And actually, you rarely look at you look at the contractual obligation, but more than often than not, if you have the right relationship with the counterparty, you'll have a conversation first. So, you know, it was that balance that really helped, I think.
Really interesting that you talk about getting the IP sorted and everything sorted up front as if you are going to get investment. I interviewed a lawyer a couple of weeks ago, and we were sort of talking about what you need to do to get ready for investment, and that, you know, quite often people go to get investment and then they haven't got those bits ready, but you're ready from day one, which is amazing. And so you did need to get investment, didn't you? You tell me about your investment story, how you got investment, because that's a nice little story.
Yeah, so the Startup Series is a competition that happens every month. It's really a way of getting sort of, it's mainly SEIS investments, so up to 150K. And in the February before we launched, I'd entered this competition with like a set of prototypes, because we hadn't manufactured all of our products. And I was like, this is amazing, they're going to love it. And we didn't, you know, we made the second stage, third stage, and we didn't get through. And I was just like, oh my God. And I hadn't, bear in mind, I hadn't done any investment before. I hadn't gone to the market. I just assumed I would get like this competition. But what was amazing was this. After the initial sting of the rejection, they email you a grid of feedback, and it's graph and it's feedback. It's very short and snappy. And it was so, I had to close it down, and I came back to it a week later, and it was about strength of team, how we'd put our ambitions through, you know, how we'd articulated the market opportunity, stuff that was really obvious to us. We'd just been bad at articulating it. And also some of the ambition we had for the brand, it was like we had in private, but we were shy to really disclose where we thought this would go. And getting that feedback was the best thing we could have got, because we were like, oh my goodness, they just want to see the true ambition for where we think the brand could go with investment, not with us limping along, funding it ourselves. And I then stopped looking for investment because we'd launched, we were getting good sales in, we'd got some retailers in, and I could see it being sustainable. But in a bizarre way, I was just about to go on maternity leave. And I was also having my busiest year at work because we were doing a massive corporate transaction. So we were working like 7 days a week in work. So it was just like, oh my God. But when I went on maternity leave, I'd been on so much high adrenaline that it was just impossible to not do anything. So I just thought, well, I'll just dust off the investment. It was like 2 weeks to, you know, have the baby. I was like, I'll re-pitch your investment. And I wrote to the guy, said, I want to reapply. And he said, go on then. And I said, I've taken on board everything you said. And then, you know, we got the investment through that. And I was, you know, heavily, heavily pregnant when I went in for the big investor deep dive. And I just had, and we got the investment when I was in the hospital being induced.
I know. So. I love that story. That's amazing. You just totally nailed it, didn't you, whilst you're having a baby at the same time. incredible. So that's so good. And then how long did it sort of take for all of that to go through and for you to get the money and do all the due diligence and all those things that you'd got yourself so well prepared for? How long did it take to actually kind of get the money in the bank?
Oh, a couple of weeks. It was really quick. So, I mean, the biggest impediment, actually, I say a couple of weeks, but there was an impediment because there was a bit of a wrinkle in certain things that were happening with EIS at the time. And it's nothing to do with us. It was just a resubmission of something that had to happen. But from offer, the term sheet was done in plain English, the shareholders agreement, the option agreements, all the documents were written for like a 12-year-old to be able to understand it. I still did get a corporate lawyer to look over a couple of things, but their whole premise is that they don't want to get caught up with long, unwieldy transaction documents. They just want to give you the money as quickly as you can and get you to execute on your plan, because that's where they see the growth opportunity. So the money came through, and they were almost, you know, we had the board meeting like a week later, the first one, to set out the plan and our goals and, you know, how we were going to achieve them, how we would scale up, what we would spend the money on. And, you know, they've been really great. We took an investor director from Worth Capital who sits on our board, and they keep us on track.
I think it's really important. I've also done a couple of, well, I've talked about this on a couple of podcasts before, but the importance of a diverse board. And a lot of startups don't actually have a board of, you know, they've obviously, they're directors themselves, but they don't have non-execs or other people involved. And when we set up our business, we did from day one. I don't know why we just did it. It was kind of like the done thing. And Rob was his name. He brought so much value to the business. It was just great to have sort of someone who was able to bring their own value and wisdom and knowledge and things like that. So I think that's really good that you've got that. And so how are you planning to spend your investment now you've got it, or have you already spent it?
No, we haven't. And I'm a bit shy to spend it because having been, you know, when you are a startup that you cash funded it yourself with a post office loan, you are really fearful of cash burn. You know, that's my biggest fear. Have we got enough money in the bank? But with the biggest chunk that was goes two areas it needed to go to when we pitched for investment. One, manufacturing, because we needed to be able to scale to get a bigger order in, because it's the products that will then generate cash for the business. And two, marketing. So customer acquisition is becoming really expensive on D2C. But to be fair, we'd only spent 600 quid in the first 6 months of launch on marketing. So they were, you know, for us to have had customers, repeat customers and retailers, with so little spent on marketing, that was quite positive for investors to know, okay, well, you should be moving the dial in your favor when you start to spend on acquisition. But it's been slower than I had imagined, because finding marketing expertise and trusted marketing expertise is hard in the digital space. People, you know, need to understand omnichannel distribution. They need to understand the technology, how to spend it, understand the metrics, as well as understand, I guess, our brand. And we're sort of a bit of a family brand. It's been tricky. It's not that we don't have an appetite to spend it, but it's we want to make sure we use it wisely. And make as few mistakes as possible. That said, we will make mistakes, and we know that not everything will work in marketing. We're testing a few things which are a bit crazy, but I think as a startup, we do have to try some of the stranger things to see if we can.
What are those stranger things? Are they secrets?
They're not secrets, but they're just different ways of doing affiliate or different platforms where we've advertised, or collaborations with very, you know, sort of value-led businesses, but that are not in beauty. We had started with some live events, live events in yoga. Obviously, that shut down because of COVID. But just being a little bit like, what could a bigger brand not do?
I think that's the great thing, isn't it? It's about always testing and refining and reporting on what's working. And if you do that, it becomes quite clear what's working. And the other thing that you said that I think is really great is that you're getting repeat orders. And with business like yours, it's all about the lifetime value of your customers. And if they're coming back, then you're obviously doing an amazing job and you've got a great product. And that's so important. And something else I wanted to talk about. So it's a gender neutral product, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a specific reason for that? Or talk to me about that.
Yeah, we were really interested in the idea of non-binary beauty because, you know, skincare is predominantly, you know, kind of female-led. Sort of, you don't see many brands on the market that cater to men or women, or actually in the natural space to men. And so we could see that there was an interest in men being interested in using better products and in natural products, but it was so binary how they were being marketed to. And actually, what if, you know, skin is skin? You know, you might have skin concerns that are dry, but you can have that if you're a man and you can have that if you're a woman. It's not because you're a man or you're a woman. So we were like this idea of like, what if, you know, our products talk to skin concerns, but not to gender. So that was always the premise that we started off on. And we also knew visually that we didn't want sort of like saccharine pink or peach or millennial, you know, whatever, pastel, that it just seemed to be everywhere for women to define like what a women's skincare product is about. We wanted just something that was quite grown up, understated, and you know, versatile. What about sharing your skincare? You know, maybe not so much now post-COVID, but you could technically, you know, have your cleanser and you have it on the bottom shelf. Something, you know, we were just much more interested in this fluid nature of a product being used in that way.
Well, I was just going to say, Alex and I are both using your oil. So we both got it and we've got two, and I don't know whose is whose, but we're both using each other's. But that's so nice because, like you said, it's solving a problem. It doesn't matter if it's me or it's him.
Yeah. And the branding has been so important for us to getting men interested in our brand by having it just neutral and not talking to a particular gender. We've got about 18% of our orders are through men, which doesn't sound a lot, but it is a lot considering lots of brands are only for women. And my aim is to bring that up to about 40%. I really, really want to be the brand that men or, you know, go to as well as women.
I absolutely love the branding. So we're coming to a close now, but just quickly wanted to ask you, I see that you keep winning awards for everything. Is that right? Getting commended, highly commended. How have you managed to do that in such a short space of time? Obviously, the products are amazing. Have you been manually entering these awards, or how does that work?
We enter awards. We send lots of products out for people to test. You know, we really care about what people think about the products and getting the awards. I don't care about badges as much, but in beauty, you sort of do need to have them because otherwise consumers will say, yeah, but are you any good? I can say you're good, but actually a badge awarded by an independent body of beauty experts speaks, you know, thousands of words. And we really spent time on the formulation and using great ingredients in high quantities. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I struggle with to tell that story better, because I know it. I know this product is amazing. I know we haven't skimped on anything that's gone into it. And I just feel I've started to stop feeling shy to say it, because you sort of feel very modest about it. But I think we need to just articulate that better to people.
I think that's one of the, I mean, I think that's a problem that we all have, being modest. But actually, when we tell people how we can help them and, you know, those things, that's amazing. And that's kind of what's going to sell it. And yeah, your product's incredible. I love the branding. You've done amazingly already. You've got 3 children and you're working and you're managing to launch a disruptive skincare brand. And I think there's lots of exciting things in the pipeline for you. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on, Zafran. It's been fantastic. I'll link to you in the show notes, but is there anywhere in particular you like to connect with the audience, on Instagram or LinkedIn?
Yeah, Instagram is great. 5.botanics, FIVEDOT botanics. Instagram is where we hang out, really. And you can check us out on Pinterest, and obviously our website's the same.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Starting to Scale with Emmy Faust. That's me. It has been great to have you listening again this week. If you know other founders that are looking to grow profitable, sustainable businesses, then please do let them know about this. And it would make my day if you leave me a review on iTunes and let me know what you are enjoying from this podcast. If you want to get in touch, you can do that through my website, emmyfaust.com. And don't forget, I've got lots of great resources on my website. Go to emmyfaust.com/free. Have a fantastic week, and I look forward to catching up with you again next week.